We are talking today with Stephen Hill. Stephen Hill is a political writer and senior fellow at the New America Foundation. His articles have appeared in numerous publications, including the San Francisco Examiner, Salon, American Prospect, Al Jazeera, The Atlantic, The Nation, and In These Times. He is the author of the books Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope in an Insecure Age. And he is here to talk about his new book, Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. Stephen, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us again today.
Thanks, Mike. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So start out, talk about what was your motivation in writing your new book, Raw Deal?
Well, I live in San Francisco, where many of the companies known as the sharing economy or gig economy are located. And so, you know, for the last few years, watching what was happening all around me, these companies starting out, I think in some ways, as a pretty interesting and even good idea, and then morphing into just bigger and bigger metastasized companies that now are what I call the share the crumbs economy. You know, interviewing many people around San Francisco who are just being steamrolled by these companies, people being evicted from their buildings because of Airbnb as professional real estate operatives take over the buildings and turn them into Airbnb tourist hotels, Uber drivers who have been trying to make it work on this platform in a difficult environment because of the economy. And, you know, initially thinking, oh, this might be an interesting, flexible way to make some extra money. And then after driving it for a while, just really realizing, as one driver told me, they treat you like gum on the bottom of their shoe. And so, you know, and enough of this was accumulating around me at a certain point. And then I started also looking at the traditional economy and how more and more businesses are starting to use contractors and temp workers and freelancers instead of hiring regularly employed people, because regular employed people have things like safety nets, health care, Medicare, Social Security, injured worker compensation, paid vacations, paid sick leave. And so suddenly by hiring a contractor as a business, you can save 30% on your labor costs by not having to provide any of this safety net for people. And so, you know, started really looking at how these businesses in Silicon Valley are pioneering this new model, this freelancer society. And I sort of juxtapose that to what we've had, which, what I call the New Deal Society, and starting to realize, wow, there is something really quite alarming what's going on here. But it's creeping up on all of us. And many people are getting caught up and thinking like, well, I've used Airbnb and it, you know, I kind of enjoyed it. And, Uber can be pretty darn convenient sometimes, especially compared to taxis, which provide pretty bad service in many, many cities. And so that convenience is sort of justifying it, and people aren't looking at the bigger issues, the environmental issues, the labor issues that are really need to be looked at in order to try and regulate these new businesses in a way that might make them actually be helpful to us instead of what they're becoming.
And that seems to be the gist of the comments I see for your articles that are coming out, is that people are saying, well, what's the big deal here? There are people, for instance, like with Uber. Regular people are making a few extra bucks with their car that they, already own. What have you got against that?
Yeah, and I, I hear that a lot. People saying like, I asked my Uber driver and, he said, and it is usually a he, that, it's working pretty good for him. And what I usually say to people is ask that driver how long he's been driving for Uber, because the clear pattern I've seen in talking to many, many drivers is that the longer you've been driving for Uber and the more hours per week you drive for Uber, if you're really trying to actually make a living on this, the more you dislike it. The fact is that, Uber's own numbers show that about half of its drivers last a year on its platform, and then they leave, because by that point, you've gone through a couple of pay cuts from Uber. They cut drivers' pay on a regular basis because they're in the middle of a fare war with taxi companies and with its Lyft and other ride-sharing competitors, and they're mounting that fare war on the backs of drivers. So they both cut the amount that the drivers receive per mile, But then they also have been steadily increasing the amount that Uber takes of each fare. When Uber first started out a few years ago, they took about 5% of each fare. Now they're taking 25 to 30%. And some drivers swear that they're taking even higher than that. Some drivers tell me they can't even figure out how much they make on Uber. Everything is so opaque with Uber, and you can't really contact, you know, pick up the phone and talk to someone at Uber. It's all done by email and text and all this kind of stuff. So drivers, after they've been on this platform for a while, they leave because they just realize, you know, maybe that was good for a little bit of time, but I need to find something better because there's no future in driving for Uber.
So what type of contract or agreement do people who participate in Uber make?
Well, as contractors with Uber, you basically, I mean, Uber will tell you you're the CEO of your own driving business. That's what they like to tell. You know, that's what all the sharing economy says. TaskRabbit, you know, they say you're the CEO of your own house cleaning business. And, you know, last time I looked, most CEOs are making millions and millions of dollars. As the CEO of your driving business, you know, many, many drivers at this point are saying they're barely making minimum wage. In addition to, as a contractor, you don't have access to any safety net. So Uber doesn't provide health care, social security. They don't even provide injured worker compensation. So many, many Uber drivers have gotten injured while driving for whatever reason, from passengers injuring them to, you know, accidents and all sorts of things. And Uber just basically tells them, sorry, you're on your own. You know, you have to pay for your own medical bills. If you're too injured to keep working, you have to be able to cover yourself while you recover. There's no injured worker compensation with these jobs, any contractor jobs in the United States. And so this is the type of thing where as a driver, you realize you might be the CEO of your own business, but your business is not exactly thriving. And in fact, you have, you know, there's a lot of problems can occur. And drivers also have to cover their own expenses. There are considerable expenses that you have as a driver, from your own gasoline to keeping your car clean to auto insurance. You're supposed to have commercial insurance in order to drive, which is quite expensive. Many drivers don't have it, and their personal insurance doesn't allow them to use their car for commercial purposes. As a driver and as a freelancer in general, you know, you don't get paid while waiting for the next fare or the next job. You basically are only paid for when you're actually driving that car. So you don't, there's no 9-to-5 where you're paid every minute that you're at your job, in other words. So there's significant risk that has been passed on to the backs of workers in this freelance society.
Do you have a sense for how many Uber drivers there are out there participating in their program?
Well, Uber says that they have about 163,000 drivers nationwide. 80% of those are driving part-time. About half of those drive 15 hours or fewer. So this is very much a part-time and temporary job for most drivers. In Seattle, the numbers I've seen, there's about 10,000 Uber drivers. And here's the thing. You know, people like the convenience of, you know, you hit that app and the driver shows up in 5 or 10 minutes. How has Uber been able to realize this miracle of basically allowing everyone to have their own private limo driver? I mean, this is like, you know, Americans' great fantasy, right? Well, they've done it by flooding the streets with cars. And have you noticed how the traffic is getting more congested in Seattle? Same in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, in New York City. The traffic is getting extremely congested because there are so many drivers out there now trying to make a living with their cars. I mean, you just can't allow a company to flood the streets with cars and not expect that there's going to be adverse consequences in terms of the environment, congestion, more cars belching carbon monoxide. There goes your city goals for climate change. You know, this is the downsides. And on top of that, you get that car in 5 or 10 minutes, but now you're sitting in traffic 15 or 20 minutes longer. So we're having a clash of conveniences here about, you know, what do we do with our streets? You have to think of our streets as a public utility. And if the streets are a public utility, like, you know, the electricity system and other types of utilities we have, you have to regulate it with the public interest in mind and not the interest of this one company that wants to keep flooding the streets with cars. And that's what's going on right now.
Well, it's interesting because, again, in the responses to your articles, people who use both participate in Uber and support it say that you're getting cars off the road by using this service. You know, you're helping the environment by doing this.
Right. This is what the CEO of Uber, Travis Kalanick, has tried to put out there that, you know, this is going to somehow help the environment. I mean, it's just laughable. They're putting more cars on the streets. That's what's happening. And in fact, they've been, you know, as you can imagine, people have started to study this thing, and they found that 50% of riders who are using Uber, they are using Uber instead of using other modes of transportation, including public transit, bicycling, and walking. So fewer people are using those three modes. Instead, now they're using Uber. It clearly, this is bad for the environment, and there's absolutely no studies that have been done that have shown that this is good for the environment.
So it sounds like then Uber is just primarily supplying the phone app and the technology so that any other citizen that has the phone app can connect to the drivers. What else are they bringing to the table for all this?
You know, they claim that they're providing some work, paid work, for people in a bad economy. The big propaganda rap they've been putting out lately is that we're helping the middle class. And, you know, you see David Plouffe, who ran Barack Obama's campaign in 2008. He is now the chief Uber PR flack, who's out there promoting this idea that this is somehow helping the middle class. And certainly, I mean, you know, being able to make some money by driving for Uber is better than sitting on your couch watching TV with no income coming in, if that's your only option. But as I said, if this was such a great job, then why are so many drivers leaving Uber after driving for it for a year? And why are so many drivers not driving it more hours? I mean, 80% of drivers are doing this part-time. Why wouldn't they drive it more hours per week if this was such a great job paying so much money? I was at a conference just a couple weeks ago in San Francisco, and David Plouffe was at this conference, and he was doing the usual, you know, Uber, we're great, we're providing for the middle class. He was putting all that out there. And a driver came to the microphone during the Q&A. And you could have heard a pin drop in that room, because this driver just basically nailed David Plouffe on everything he was saying. This driver said, look, I've been driving for Uber for a couple of years. I'm barely making minimum wage. Here's the problems that you have with this, the rating system, you know, how people, you know, a guy jumps in the car and says, I'm late for the airport. If you don't break every speeding law in order to get me to the airport on time, I'm going to give you a poor rating. You know, supposedly this is you're supposed to be the CEO of your own driving business. Well, Uber just shut off its platform, 350 drivers in Los Angeles whose approval rating, whose acceptance rating of accepting rides from passengers was too low. The reason why they weren't accepting rides from certain passengers was because any passenger that wants to go a mile or two in very congested traffic, that driver knows they're going to sit there in traffic for 20, 25 minutes using up gas, and they're not going to make any money on that ride. So if you're the CEO of your own driving business and you can't refuse a ride that you know you're going to lose money on, I mean, you know, what kind of driving business have you created? And so Plouffe, you know, and Uber ignore all of this. And this driver just said, when I tried to voice some concerns to Uber, they shut me off the platform. So the unilateralism of this company to be able to just cut you off this platform, not allow any type of back and forth, you know, conversation, much less negotiation, is really a problem for many of these drivers. That's why, you know, one of them told me, you feel like you're gum on the bottom of this company's shoe. And that's why in Seattle there has been legislation introduced to create collective bargaining for these Uber drivers. And, of course, Uber is opposed to this. David Plouffe came to Seattle to oppose this. I mean, think of what this is saying. David Plouffe is a highly placed Democratic Party operative. He has contacts all within the Democratic Party, including the presidential campaigns like Hillary Clinton and others. And so we have a major Democrat who is taking an anti-labor position, saying that these drivers should not be collectively bargaining and organizing. This is a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. If the Democratic Party is suddenly going to be anti-labor, that marks a whole new moment in the downward spiraling of the Democratic Party as a party that represents the interests of working people. And that's what David Plouffe is doing right now. We'll see if this catches on with Hillary Clinton and some of the other top Democrats. But it's a troubling sign, I think, within the Democratic Party.
So how much is the people at the top who are running Uber making?
on this? They're making billions. I mean, you know, Travis Kalanick, the CEO of Uber, is estimated to be worth $4 or $5 billion. The company itself has been valued at $51 billion. That's almost as much as General Motors, even though Uber hasn't made a single thing. They don't own any cars. They don't even claim to be employing anyone because all these drivers are contractors, CEOs of their own business. They don't work directly for Uber. So, you know, these high-flying valuations are – there's a lot of smoke and mirrors involved, but this company is pulling in a lot of revenue, and they're spending a lot as they're trying to spread around the world for their global empire. And the people making money are not the drivers. Let's just put it that way.
So, and what kind of background check is done on potential drivers by Uber?
The background checks are really inadequate. In fact, the district attorneys of Los Angeles and San Francisco have sued Uber over their background checks because Uber actually charges $2, used to be a dollar, now it's been doubled to $2 for what's called a safety fee for each fare. And that $2 is supposed to be used to fund the background checks for drivers. And these background checks are inadequate. They don't do any fingerprinting, which is considered the gold standard when it comes to background checks. Every taxi company that I've seen does do fingerprint checking. So the idea that Uber's background checks are the best in the industry, as they like to brag, is completely false. And, you know, the background checks have had tragic consequences. Two New Year's Eves ago in San Francisco, an Uber driver took a right-hand turn into a crosswalk, plowed over a family in San Francisco, killed a six-year-old girl, and badly injured her eight-year-old brother and her mother. And Uber, of course, completely absolved themselves of any responsibilities. They said, oh, we're really sorry about that, but this driver is a contractor. He doesn't work for Uber. We have no liability here. And they tried to wiggle out of any type of liability whatsoever for what the driver did. But here's the thing. That driver had been arrested in Florida for reckless endangerment with a car for driving 100 miles per hour on a city street trying to pass someone. So Uber's background check did not uncover that, and this driver killed a little six-year-old girl.
Did you say there was 10,000 in Seattle?
10,000 drivers is what Uber's saying. Now, they're not all driving at the same time, but, you know, thousands
people
of them.
10,000 people have signed up to be Uber drivers.
That's right, and they've actually driven on the platform for some amount of time.
And 163,000 nationally. You would think with that kind of reach that the company could at least help their drivers perhaps acquire better car insurance or acquire the insurance that they are saying that they're getting for them.
Yeah, I mean, they don't have insurance. In fact, not only do they not have insurance, but what Uber has begun doing is offering subprime loans for drivers to buy their cars, you know, because you need to have a pretty nice car or Uber won't approve it. And a lot of the drivers can't afford it. So they actually recruited someone from Goldman Sachs to come and design this loan program for them. How about that for irony of ironies, to design these subprime loans. So some of these drivers are taking out loans and paying, according to the drivers, 20 to 22% interest on these loans in order to drive a car. And then if they do something wrong and they get shut off the platform, they're stuck with these loans to pay for these cars. So this is the type of things that Uber is doing in order to spread its empire. I mean, Uber is desperate for drivers. In order to flood the streets with cars so that you, the consumer, only have to wait 5 or 10 minutes for that car to show up. They just need a ton of drivers. And with drivers leaving the platform after a year, you know, down the street from my house in San Francisco, Uber set up a table at the gas station, kind of like, you know, someone doing a bake sale. And they're recruiting, going up to male drivers at the pumps, pumping gas, and saying, hey, come drive for Uber. We're giving bonuses right now if you sign up and drive a few shifts. So, I mean, Uber is desperate for drivers, and this is their Achilles heel. They treat their drivers so terribly, and yet they desperately need more drivers.
So talk about Uber from the standpoint of those people that use it. What is the concept of surge pricing? And when I try and use or hire an Uber driver, is that something I would know about?
Yeah, most people who are taking an Uber, they assume it's like a taxi, except it's not in one rather odd sense. They have something called surge pricing, where in order to attract more drivers out during times of peak demand, the price for that drive can go up 2, 3, 4, 5. There's been examples of it going up 10 times what it normally costs. So, you know, you might take an Uber early in the evening and it costs you maybe $20 to take that Uber. And then you take the same ride back later in the evening, and there have been anecdotes, stories out there of where the price has gone up to $250, $350, $450 to take that Uber back to where you went, because they're trying to attract more drivers out there. I mean, the thing that's kind of comical about it is that drivers are figuring out the only time they make money on Uber is during periods of surge pricing. And so they're doing things like in San Diego, these drivers they all log on to the app. So the algorithm thinks, okay, we have so many drivers available right now. Then they go to a Pizza Hut and they all sit around for a couple of hours having pizza and beer, and they log off the app. So suddenly the algorithm thinks, oh, we have fewer drivers and we don't have enough. And so then it kicks off the surge pricing. The drivers finish their pizza and beer and they log back in and they go out and drive during peak surge pricing. So you, the consumer, pay for that. It's understandable why the drivers are doing this, because they're manipulating the surge pricing in order to make a bit more money. And Uber just, they know this is going on, and yet they insist on having this surge pricing in effect. So it's led to a lot of strange pricing mechanisms that, I think are really anti-consumer.
All right. So you cover other similar companies in your book. Talk about the other best-known one, at least to me, which is Airbnb. What's the problems with Airbnb?
Sure. Airbnb is an example of something that started out as a good idea. In its early years, it was offering, the opportunity for people to rent out a spare room in their house, particularly, in the aftermath of the collapse of the economy in 2008. People needed ways to make money. Seemed like a good idea. Now you flash forward to 2015, and it's turned into something quite different. What's happened is Airbnb has been invaded by professional real estate operatives who have figured out that they can circumvent various laws that were put in place in order to make a lot more money with their housing. And by renting out the local housing stock, there's fewer houses now available for local people because they're being all rented out to tourists. Most cities have in place and have had in place for many years a law that said that you can't rent out your place for fewer than 30 days. The reason why those laws were in place was to prevent the owners of the housing stock, landlords and what have you, from turning it into a football between the needs of local residents who need housing and tourists. That was why these laws were put into place. Along comes a service like Craigslist and allowed more people to start basically breaking this law, but it was happening at a level that was pretty low, and so it didn't really affect the housing stock. But now Airbnb has come along and it has ripped open this giant loophole for these professional real estate operatives to start renting out their buildings to tourists instead of to local people. And what do I mean by professional real estate operators? Well, there's a few different types that we see on the Airbnb platforms. Some are landlords who evict people from buildings. In San Francisco, I've interviewed many, many people who have been evicted from buildings in certain parts of the town in order to clear those buildings and turn them into Airbnb tourist hotels. And, we're talking about seniors, disabled people. This one building that I went and visited, a man in the advanced stages of Parkinson's disease being evicted. People have lived in these rent-controlled apartments for 15, 20, 25 years, suddenly being evicted. And, Chinatown was particularly hard hit. Language minority people who, have a harder time defending themselves because these landlords are using loopholes in the law to get people out. They'll do things like owner-occupied move-in, saying, I'm moving into the building now, I'm getting out of the rental business. And this one building, the elderly woman who owned the building, who lived in the building, died and willed it to her niece in Southern California, who issued eviction notices immediately for all four units in that building, telling them, I'm moving in. Well, how can you possibly move into four units? Well, she said, my relatives from other parts of the country are also moving to San Francisco, and they're moving into the other units. And so it's clearly, was a falsehood in order to get people out. But who's going to be around to monitor that building to see if they actually move in? So they're using a lot of loopholes like this to get people out of the buildings, turn them into Airbnb hotels. Then other types of operatives are absentee owners. They buy a home in a place like Seattle, And instead of living in it, they rent it out, and they use professional property managers who rent out these properties. Some of the hosts on Airbnb control dozens of properties. So these are not regular people renting out a spare room. These are professionals. And independent analyses that has been done of the Airbnb website has found that about 40% of the listings on Airbnb are from hosts that have multiple properties, not just a spare room in their home. About half of the revenue from Airbnb in Seattle is coming from these sorts of professionals. So these are not regular people, as Airbnb is trying to say. There's a huge number of people on this platform who are professionals. And here's the thing. Airbnb knows it because they have the numbers. They know what the numbers are on their platform and who's doing what, how many. They know there are hosts on there renting out dozens of properties. And with one flick of the computer mouse, they could, you know, knock these people off of that platform. In San Francisco, they've actually passed a law saying hosts have to register with the city. But it's so hard to enforce, only 10% of the hosts have registered. If Airbnb really wanted to be a cooperative corporation, they could say to those hosts, look, if you're not registered with this city, that's the law. You can't be on our platform until you're registered. Airbnb knows who is and isn't registered and who's still on their platform, and yet they don't. They try to put up this facade of we're the sharing economy company, we're the trust and belonging company, and yet they're totally, you know, a $25 billion valued company who is driven by its venture capitalist funders heading towards an IPO that wants to be this global empire on home sharing. And so this is really who Airbnb is, despite the facade that they try to put forward about regular people using their platform. That is going on the platform still, people renting out the sharing, you know, an extra room in their house. But it's gone way beyond that to the professionals dominating this platform.
And how much both with Uber and Airbnb are local taxes being affected, the local tax base?
They're totally evading taxes. These companies don't pay taxes. So Uber does not pay, in most places, the local livery tax that taxi cab companies have to pay. Airbnb is not paying, in most places, the hotel tax that that hotels have to pay. And so this is a loss of revenue for the local governments, and it's a significant loss. In San Francisco, Airbnb, in order to head off a political voter initiative, finally started paying its taxes and paid $25 million in back taxes and now is paying about $12 million a year. Of course, no one knows if that's even enough because you don't have the numbers to know how much they're really supposed to pay. But here's the thing. I mean, in terms of Airbnb, they say they're in about 34,000 cities around the world, and they're only paying taxes in about a dozen of them. I mean, Airbnb and Uber are asserting this new corporate right. Because if you think about it, like say if you're a corporation like DuPont, you can't go set up a chemical plant in some state or some city or in India or wherever and say, we're going to set up the plant first and figure out the tax laws and the local regulations later on. Airbnb is saying, you know, we're in so many cities, we want to be taxed, but the laws are too complicated. It's going to take us time to figure out all the local laws to pay our taxes and follow the laws. Well, at the rate they're going, it's going to take them 50 to 60 years. You know, they're only doing 12 out of 34,000. But they have asserted this new right that they can start operations now and figure out the local taxation laws and the local regulations later on. I mean, imagine if every corporation operated this way. Imagine if Google or Microsoft could set up an operation here in Seattle and say, we're going to set up now, and we'll figure out how much taxes we owe you and what local laws we have to follow later on. Trust us. We want to do this. We're a sharing trust economy company here. We just haven't had time to get to it yet, you all, because the laws are kind of complicated. That's the new corporate right that Uber and Airbnb and some of these sharing economy companies are asserting. We'll start operating now and figure out the details later.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. It's a half hour is not enough to cover this issue, clearly.
Yeah. No, there's a lot to cover. But the thing that for people to be aware of is just there are other companies out there setting up labor brokerage websites and, you know, doing similar things that are not good for workers, not good for communities and families. So we just have to really be aware of what these companies are really about and not fall for the hype and the propaganda they're putting out.
All right. Well, with that, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming in again and spending time with us today.
It's my pleasure, Mike. Thank you.
We've just been talking with Stephen Hill. He is a political writer and senior fellow at the New American Foundation and author of the new book, Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers.